You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Today's show is brought to you by the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight. Their most recent episode is about building civic power and reclaiming democracy with guest Sabeel Rahman. Whether you need the motivation to get involved politically or the tips to succeed in civic engagement, they've got you covered. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 14th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of History from Johns Hopkins University, Martha Jones. Her book, Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Also on the program today, wildfires and toxic stupidity poison the air in the West. Meanwhile, polls have Biden up in Arizona and Minnesota. The real question is, will that matter? Because Republicans plan to disenfranchise voters in key swing states, well underway with Florida ex-convicts, the latest. Meanwhile, Trump brags that murder suspect Michael Reinhold's killing by police was an extrajudicial retribution. Trump's political appointees at the CDC have been actively undermining the agency's COVID-19 mortality reporting. And despite detentions and arrests, tens of thousands of Belarusians pour into the streets calling for a new election. Meanwhile, fishy new claims from the White House that Iran is looking to assassinate an ambassador reek as a prelude to an October surprise. College has become the new COVID hotspot. And many in the U.S. State Department could face war crimes charges for our continued enablement of Saudi strikes in Yemen. A top Durham aide quits the investigation into the investigators because of DOJ pressure to release early results. And lastly, Trump celebrates Herman Cain in Nevada by holding his first indoor rally since Tulsa. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Apologize for the late start. We've had some technical difficulties today. Internets are shaky. Third-party broadcasters are shaky, et cetera, et cetera. But thank you for joining us. We're running a little bit late, but we will get to our guest shortly. Let's get right into this segment on Fox and Friends. I think this is this morning. With now very close to 200,000 people dead, I think we're at 195,000. Certainly, we'll be at 200,000 by the middle of this month, or I should say in a week or so. With the recent poll that shows that 35% of Americans approve of the way that Donald Trump has been handling this pandemic. And of course, the pandemic is not Donald Trump's fault. But the idea that tens of thousands, if not more, people have lost their lives because Donald Trump was worried about panicking the stock market. And for other reasons that I think I just remain incomprehensible to me, is trying to pretend like this thing doesn't exist. The argument that tens of thousands, if not, I don't know, 100,000 more have lost their lives because of the failure of this administration to take coronavirus seriously and to competently address it. We have stories now about how communications people within the CDC are harassing those who put out the mortality figures because it is contrary to, I don't know, Trump's policy to admit that people have died from COVID-19. So the right is in full effect in trying to, in some way, defend Donald Trump. And I think this is a rear guard type of situation because he is bleeding senior citizen support because they started this all out by saying Americans need to be tough and sacrifice old people for so that, I guess, I don't know, college kids can party. Here is Brian Kilmeade and Tom Cotton, I think who perceives himself as an heir to the Trump constituency, trying to make excuses for Donald Trump. And this one's pretty rich.
So Scott Gottlieb kind of blew me away yesterday on Face the Nation. And, you know, he's an outsider. He has insight and he's respecting the administration. He's been critical of the administration. And he just sobered everybody up, took politics out of it and said, look, I was calling the CDC. I was saying, are you sure we're looking at this in the right way? Are you sure you're treating this as a flu? What do you mean it's not here? Are you sure it's not here yet? And he said, the president has to count on his science people. And if his science people are telling him one thing that is serious, but we have a test for it and we're treating it like treating it one way and it ends up coming in a different way, what do you expect the president who spent 50 years in business to know about this pandemic that's the first thing like it we've seen since 1918?
Yeah, Brian, I think Scott was right about that. You know, Dr. Fauci has even said that he didn't hear any discrepancy between what the president said publicly and what the president said privately at the start of the pandemic. And Dr. Fauci and many of our other public health professionals were recommending against mask usage as late as late February and early March. They later reversed that as more evidence came to light. But the president was acting on the best advice of his advisors as early as January. I can tell you because I was part of those conversations about banning travel from China.
It's stunning that they're attempting to push this when we have audio recording of Donald Trump in the first week of February being quite explicit as to what they knew about COVID. It goes through the air and it is five times more deadly than the flu. And yet they insist on blaming just about anybody they can. And it's almost, I mean, I guess we have to wait for it to be a fit, but it is undoubted in my mind that we're going to hear, I don't know, depending on what happens with this election, maybe either way, 6 months from now, that the reason why the hesitation on the masks, the reason why the medical people were not running around with their hair on fire was because of the pressure they were getting from the administration, because he clearly knew. And then he rolled out a new talking points within 10 days of telling Bob Woodward that this thing was as deadly as it was and as communicable as it was. But, you know, I guess, I don't know, Fox and Friends, it's one way you're going to be able to cash a check.
It's depressing the two-step that these guys play with Fauci, where they just bash him incessantly. And then when they need to like cite him for propaganda value, it works for them as like, look at even I'll cite Fauci, the guy right. That we all hate.
And this, you know, they talk about we cut off the Chinese. Of course, I don't know. Somehow this went down the memory hole. But the early instances of COVID in this country came from Europe. It was like you talk about closing the barn door after the cows have left. Damn. A couple of quick ads, and then we will get to our guest. Every morning, as is my ritual, I make a pot of coffee and I make a jug of the Liquid IV Energy Multiplier. In fact, I have mine right here. And you'll see I've already taken a glass of it. That's basically the way I start. I have two times over the course of the day where I need a little bit of an energy boost at like 9:30, 10 in the morning, and then throughout the show. Now, you probably all know Liquid IV for their popular hydration drink mix. We've talked about it a lot. But their newest line, the Energy Multiplier, I have to admit, is my favorite. It's got 100 milligrams of clean caffeine. It's the perfect coffee replacement, or in my case, supplement, because I like both flavors and I like my caffeine in multiple different directions. It's an all-natural alternative to process energy drinks for a sustained energy boost throughout the day. Like I say, throughout the show, I will finish this bottle. I'll have one cup at 10:30, 10, and then I'll mix in between my coffee and this. Half of Americans report that they struggle with daily fatigue. Nothing to be embarrassed about, particularly now. Who's sleeping well? I'm not. With Liquid IV Energy Multiplier, you can upgrade your vibe. You can reach your constant state of awesome, as it were, or in my case, you know, fairly decent. I love it. Love the taste. There's matcha in it as well. I lean on the regular Liquid IV when, you know, maybe I've indulged a little too much the night before, or back when I used to travel and you get a little bit dehydrated, or when I'm out, I don't know, working too hard, running around, chasing my kids, whatever it is. Liquid IV is the way I rehydrate myself, but the way that I boost my energy, Liquid IV's energy multiplier. Liquid IV's cellular transport technology delivers an optimal ratio of nutrients for more efficient uptake. It has enhanced rapid absorption into the bloodstream. It's non-GMO. It's vegan. It's free of gluten. It's free of dairy. It's free of soy. Liquid IV is available nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you use the promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Start fueling your adventures today at liquidiv.com, promo code MajorityRep. And big news from Harry's. They just came out with their sharpest blades ever. And of course, because it's Harry's, they're not going to charge you more for it. Harry's new sharper blades are still as low as $2. I am not a cheap person. There's been people who've in my past have argued that, but I do not like to overpay for stuff I don't need to overpay for. If I can get quality cheaply, that's what I will do. That's why I love Harry's. That and the trimmer blade head, which I keep talking about because of my asymmetrical nostrils, but we don't need to go too deep into that. Harry's new blades are so sharp that in a study with guys shaving four times a week, the guys reported that with Harry's new blades, their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. That means that they last longer. They're less expensive. I mean, if you work it out that way. Harry's owns a German factory. It's been honing razor blades for 100 years. They source their steel from Sweden and own the entire manufacturing process, allowing them to keep prices low. Plus, Harry's is so convenient. The blades are delivered directly to your door on schedule with or without a subscription. You could do it either way. They confidently stand by 100% quality guarantee on harrys.com. Give Harry's sharpest blades ever a try. Harry has an amazing offer for listeners of this show. New U.S. customers can redeem a Harry's trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You'll get a 5-blade blade razor featuring their new sharper blades. You get the weighted handle. I like the handles a lot. Foaming shave gel with aloe and a travel cover to protect your blade when you're on the go. Just go to harrys.com/majority report and redeem your free trial offer today. All right, we're going to take a I guess we don't need to take a break.
Nope.
Because we have her in the on Zoom today. Want to welcome to the program the Society of Black Alumni President and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University, author of Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All, Martha Jones. Martha, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let me get my notes here. This is you've written a history of black women's involvement in our politics for about 200 years, I guess, almost down to the day. Mm-hmm. And of course, we are a month out from the 100-year anniversary of women getting the right to vote. But your argument, I should say, that amendment only comes like chapter 7 in your book. Sort of like two-thirds, I don't know where, maybe I guess in the close to the third act in some respects.
The end of the second act, I'll
say. The second act. And that is because there is a huge history of black women not just pursuing the vote, but also political rights in this country that, like, and I'm, you know, I've recently sort of like over the past, I don't know, year, gotten much more aware and dug deeper into Reconstruction. There are so many elements of our history that have been tossed down the memory hole. Let's start with in 1820. Like why 1820 as opposed to any date before that?
So first of all, thanks for having me and having me back. I was interested first and foremost in black women's ideas. And I knew that over a very long swath of time, black women until today had leveled a rather piercing critique at American politics, a critique that decried both the role that sexism and racism had long played in arbitrating political power and political rights. So my question was, where does that come from? Where does that begin? And you begin to pull the thread and you find yourselves in the first decades of the 19th century. You find yourself reading the ideas of some rather exceptional women, a preacher, a politician, and a writer, all of whom are confronting what it means to be both politically ambitious and politically effective, and how that then brings upon them a set of barriers, right? And the barrier of sexism. And so it turns out that that critique, which sent, you know, to my students sounds very 21st century, right? No racism, no sexism, turns out to be a very old set of ideas that the women I write about in Vanguard really carry forward until our own time.
Let's, I guess it is at the, well, let's start, I guess, in 1830 with the colored convention movement. What is that? And let's talk about, is it Jerina Lee?
Jerina Lee.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, tell us about her.
So Jerina Lee is born just at the end of the American Revolution. She spends her young life as an indentured servant in New Jersey. And at adulthood migrates to Philadelphia, where she is called by God to preach the gospel. It is a remarkable turn in her life, but the strength of her calling and the strength of her capacity, her skill, her ability to bring converts into, in her example, Black Methodist churches, means that she also has to butt up against the conventions of Methodism, which do not recognize and do not authorize women to interpret the Bible. Now, to some readers, this might be a somewhat unorthodox place to begin a story of women in the vote, but Lee is one of these early thinkers who confronts and then pens a memoir in 1836 in which she recounts what it is like to challenge the authorities in her church, what it's like to be out on the road preaching and confront both ministers and lay people alike who don't think women should exercise that kind of authority. And what's important about Lee in the story is not only her own courage, but then how she really inspires more broadly Black Methodist women to come to church conferences, ready with petitions, with a strategy, looking to change church law to, in essence, make it gender neutral so that the same women who sit in the pews and raise the money, serve the meals, also have an opportunity to exercise authority. And in order to do that, Lee has to develop a political philosophy, which is one about the misplaced role that sexism and racism play in church politics. And it's a set of ideas that migrate very seamlessly into the realm of civil politics.
How conscious was she, if we can know, of that migration? In other words, like, you know, was there a specific notion in her head, like, this is where I start within the context of the church, because we have, you know, broadly speaking or narrowly speaking, more rights within the context of the church than we do in the outer, the broader society.
Yeah. So I don't think that Lee is quite that ambitious, but there are women who, if you will, grow up in her shadow who indeed are. So if we sort of move forward in time a bit to the end of the 19th century, I write about a woman named Eliza Ann Gardner. And I recognize for folks that these are not household names. That's kind of the purpose of the book,
right,
is to give us some new names in this long story of women's politics. But Eliza Ann Gardner is a young woman in Boston during Jerina Lee's heyday, if you will. And by the 1890s, Gardner is somebody who moves very forthrightly out of the politics of church to help create what becomes the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs, which is the Black women's suffrage organization of the early 20th century. So we have some women who will always center their activism in church, so they will adopt the ideas that are also percolating in the civil realm. And there are others like Eliza Ann Gardner, who very forthrightly says in her church, listen, we need to be mindful of the old politics of abolitionism and women's rights, and those values should infuse us in the church. And then she's prepared to step out of the church, create a whole new women's political organization, an organization expressly committed to winning women's votes, among other things, to talk about the kinds of values that come out of her church community.
Let's talk about Maria Miller Stewart, because I think this, in some respects, I was sort of blown away that the first woman to speak on a podium, as it were, I mean, I guess, like, I don't know what the equivalent would be today, right? But to broadcast, to the extent that one could broadcast at that time, about politics, was a Black woman.
Yes.
Presumably, right? Like, Black people at that time had less rights, broadly speaking, than white people, and that even a freed slave or a free woman, a Black woman, would have less, I don't know, acceptance in the context. I mean, explain that dynamic that's going on there and what that but says.
It's precisely that plight, right? Those circumstances that draw Maria Stewart to the podium, right? That she understands Black Americans by the 1830s to be vexed by slavery, yes, and also by anti-Black discrimination, even in a free city like Boston, where she settles. And so, as Stewart tells it, you know, she's compelled, in a sense, by the deep concerns and the demands on her community, not only to be active, right, but to get it right. The stakes are very high, in Stewart's view, and she is frustrated, right, by, in her view, a set of antiquated ideas that would relegate women to childcare and the kitchen. She's frustrated by that because she thinks her community is squandering talent, it's squandering resources. And she's got a sharp pen and a sharp tongue. And she indeed is the first American woman, as best we know, to speak about politics in front of a mixed audience, which she does in Boston in 1832. Her public speaking career is short. And Stewart explains how she is vilified, how she is chastised, and she will retire from public life after just a year or so of public speaking because her ideas and particularly her critique of sexism is intolerable to too many in Boston. But we know that she goes on to be a teacher. And her purpose over the next many decades is educating young Black women in the field of elocution. We don't say elocution much anymore, but in public speaking, right? And how to enter into public life despite the barriers and despite the admonition that women don't have a place in politics. So she's another person who's own public career is brief, but whose influence through her role as a teacher resonates out across generations. She's a model and knows the lessons, right, of what it's like to try and break barriers.
At that point, and we could actually go, I mean, we talk about the Seneca Falls in 1848, which is, of course, like the, I guess, the first, I don't know, unofficial broad convention of suffragette. The only Black person there was Frederick Douglass, which is also sort of shocking in some ways, I guess, or not, or telling, I guess, is really more relevant. But what is at this time, and maybe we can talk about Seneca Falls to some extent. What is the interplay between the abolitionist movement and the suffrage movement? I mean, what, like, does one get shunted aside, or what, I mean, what, I'm just curious what the interplay is there. Is there a certain amount of, like, I don't know. The only thing I could say, like, on Twitter, where people are like, you're not paying attention to the right issue. You should be doing this. I mean, was there that quality that was going on, or was there an understanding that these are related? Because Seneca Falls would suggest that there is a very strong sentiment that these are not related.
I think that the story that is told of Seneca Falls and much of what precedes Seneca Falls, frankly, women's anti-slavery organizing is for white American women is an important site of both consciousness raising. This is where many white American women begin to develop a critique of their own oppression as women through their study and their critical thinking about the scourge of slavery. Anti-slavery activism is where white American women win, if you will, their political savvy through anti-slavery organizing and activism. So there is an important nexus for white American women between the movement for women's rights and the movement against slavery. But you're right to point out that for African American women, this is a more sort of vexed nexus. Black women are not at Seneca Falls, for example, one of the early white women's political meetings. And when African American women, like white women, vie for leadership within an organization like the American Anti-Slavery Society, they don't fare the same. And in 1840, for example, white American women will be elected finally, controversially, to the leadership in the American Anti-Slavery Society. And at the same moment, the African American woman, Hester Lane, who has also been nominated, will not rise to the leadership, will not be elected. So there is a always more complicated story, but an important one. But it is important to recognize, I think, that if I were to, you know, just pull back and say that anti-slavery as a political position does not always equate with anti-racism, does not always equate with, you know, a proto-feminism. And so it's worth doing some careful parsing. A little bit of that I try to do in Vanguard to help us think about that with some nuance.
Right. I mean, it's just a reminder that you could be an abolitionist and also a racist who wants to send all the black people in the country to Africa. There was a whole host, I think, of
colonization, right? Yeah. Colonization is the movement that is in many ways anti-slavery. It anticipates, even wants to bring on the end of slavery in the United States, but sees as an essential companion to the end of slavery, the removal of African Americans from the country to keep it a white man's country. It is a complicated story.
All right. Now, I have to mention, just right after Seneca Falls, there is the first National Women's Rights Convention. Sojourner Truth heads there. It is in my hometown of Worcester. So I was very excited about that. I have to say that you spelt it right in the book, but in the Times, there was an H. In an op-ed that you wrote, and I'm very sensitive to that.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Folks know around here, the past couple of weeks, I've been talking about the lack of an H in Worcester. But tell us about this. Is this the first time where sort of black women begin to have a role within an institutionalized women's rights movement?
Absolutely. I mean, these are the first national women's conventions, women's rights convention. This is the beginning of a political movement that has as its premise a kind of longevity, right? If Seneca Falls and Rochester in 1848 are, you know, to some degree, one-off meetings. Right. Nobody really knows what's going to happen next. By 1850, there is a sense now that women will convene. They will convene annually. They will develop an agenda, tactics and strategies. And so these are much larger meetings. They draw delegates from many parts of the country. And African-American women are indeed in attendance. Perhaps most remembered for good reason is Sojourner Truth, the formerly enslaved woman from upstate New York, who is already a seasoned anti-slavery advocate, who comes to those meetings and helps us to appreciate the unique perspective that Black women bring to a movement for women's rights. Truth is very concerned, for example, about how that movement will regard Black women's labor and as a facet of thinking about women's rights. She is certainly concerned with the scourge of anti-Black racism, puts that on the table controversially. And so we begin to see the ways in which someone like Truth permits us to discern where the tensions might be for this movement around how to define its agenda, what its relationship is to anti-slavery, what its relationship is to civil rights, what its relationship is to the problem of colonization. And there are real fissures from the beginning in the women's conventions, some who think the participation of someone like Truth is a distraction and threatens to undermine a movement for women's rights. Truth should be in a so-called colored convention talking mm-hmm. about the problem of slavery and racism, because women's conventions should be talking about women's issues only. Now, you can hear in that, right, the dilemma for somebody right. like Truth, for whom it is impossible to extract her womanhood, if you will, from her Blackness. All of those things are part of what she has come not only to call for, but what she brings to the table as a lived experience. And so already by 1850, we can see a tension that will frankly plague the movement for women's rights and later the road to the 19th Amendment. How does that movement, where does it stand on the question of and the problem of racism, on the lived experiences of Black women?
I would argue it's the question still around, right? I mean, today, yeah. That's not the idea that the normative value of womanhood is devoid of race is a interesting perspective and valid maybe only if you are the a member of the race, the construct that has the power in society. Yeah. All right, so let's take a jump for the sake of our time, and people obviously can read the book, but let's go to the 19th Amendment. 100 years ago. It's interesting that that is the time where this passes, because it is also a time where there has been a incredible resurgence, maybe the peak of the resurgence of the KKK in this country, and sort of the peak of the, I guess, the stickiness of the lost cause myth that resulted in all of the statues that are being torn down now actually being built. Now, people got to remember, this is almost 55 years after the Civil War is when all of a sudden these monuments go up. I mean, this is a generation plus later. Yeah. And we're on full revisionism mode and full, I guess, resurgence mode for this racism coming out of, you know, Reconstruction and the failed promises of it.
Sure. So by the time we're on the road, if you will, to the 19th Amendment, Reconstruction has been overthrown, that experiment in interracial democracy. Jim Crow is now the predominates political and legal culture that includes segregation, that includes the disenfranchisement of African American men, that includes violence, intimidation and violence, including lynching. So indeed, this is the scene in which the 19th Amendment is gaining momentum. What does that mean? A lot of things. It means for African American women that it's impossible to extract their strong interest in winning the vote from the very real scourge of lynching. And so Black women are organized, as I mentioned earlier, in the National Association of Colored Women, precisely because the suffrage associations are not willing to incorporate the problem of lynching into their goals, into their agenda. And in the NACW, Black women work as hard to defeat lynching with federal legislation as they do to win the vote and the 19th Amendment. What Black women know, of course, is that if you get a federal amendment and intimidation, violence, lynching persists, it's a hollow victory. That's the lesson of the 15th Amendment. Black men win a 15th Amendment and they still can't vote because violence is unchecked. So that's one piece of the story. The other piece is that the leaders of organizations like the National Association, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, the National Women's Party have cut a bargain and basically marginalized Black women and their political concerns within the suffrage movement in an effort to win the support of white Southern women and ultimately white Southern lawmakers in Congress and in the ratification process that will follow the amendment coming out of Congress in 1919. So suffragists push for the 19th Amendment unfolds in a context where everybody knows that nothing in the amendment will keep Black women from being disenfranchised by state laws after it's ratified.
And just to be clear on the 15th Amendment, I mean, the basically, as opposed to saying that there is a universal right to vote, like a federal right to vote. I mean, this was a big part of the negotiations. It left the door open for loopholes, as it were. I mean, obviously violence, but within the legal framework, there was a big opportunity to disenfranchise people. And we're seeing it We saw it this week in Florida, for that matter. I guess that's more 13th Amendment on some level, but not quite. But we saw it, you know, and we see it throughout that really the next 45 years until we get to the Voting Rights Act. And it's sort of, we've reemerged, you know, I guess 8 years ago, where parts of that Voting Rights Act were undermined in such a way that it opened the, reopened the door again for legal vote suppression. But so ultimately the 19th Amendment for Black women in particular, simply is like almost like, I don't know, getting up to bat. And then you have the opportunity to actually, you know, do something when you're there, right? I mean, yeah. It's not quite the home run, as it were, for white women at that point, because they don't have a whole host of other rights that, or and intentions, I guess, that are focused on them to prevent them from voting and developing political power.
So, remember what the 19th Amendment says. Neither the federal government nor the states may use sex as a criteria. So all those laws that had remained on the books that posited male and men as a qualification for voting are now unconstitutional. But that doesn't mean that women have the right to vote, right? And many American women still can't vote, like age qualifications, residency qualifications, citizenship, mental competency, and more. But for African American women now, the problem with the 19th Amendment is it does not interfere with poll taxes. It does not interfere with literacy tests. It does not interfere with grandfather clauses. These are the tactics that have kept Black men from the polls. Now these are the tactics that make Black women equal, especially in the American South. And so the 19th Amendment, indeed, I'm not sure if I follow the sports metaphor, you'll forgive me, but the 19th Amendment absolutely is, has no teeth. How's that for a different sort of metaphor, right? It has no teeth. And so the states are still at liberty to keep Black women from the polls. Everyone knows that going into the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and there is little that happens other than Black women's own organizing, right? By their own mettle, do they manage some of them to get to the polls?
How much of a bargain was that? I mean, how much was there an awareness of like, look, we can narrowly tailor this in such a way that the mechanisms we use to disenfranchise people will still be at play?
This is openly spoken on the floor of Congress. This is openly spoken on the floor of state legislatures. This is not a secret, a dirty secret. It's a dirty bargain. But it is one that is made openly. And as a consequence, Black women know it's coming. They organize in suffrage schools to try and assist one another in overcoming the hurdles that they're going to confront. They turn out in fall of 1920 to register and to vote in important numbers, in collectively to help shield them against violence and retribution. And we wind up with a very uneven landscape in this country after 1920 when it comes to voting rights for women. Black women will vote in states like New York and California and Illinois, where women's suffrage had been enacted long before the 19th Amendment. In some southern cities, Black women will be able to organize and overcome the hurdles collectively and register. But in too many places throughout the South, the combination of law and violence ensures that Black women are not able to register, are not able to cast ballots, and are now, as you suggest, standing on the precipice of what becomes a new movement for voting rights, one that Black women will wage with Black men and will take us all the way to the modern civil rights era, to 1965 and the passage of the Voting Rights Act in that year.
And then and then up to, you know, things like we see it in the context of Stacey Abrams, who you
well, Sure. The Voting Rights Act is gutted to a very important degree in 2013 by the U.S. Supreme Court in Shelby versus Holder. And that opens the door in 2013 to the era in which we find ourselves in 2020, which is a new era of voter suppression, one in which, yet again, individual states are at liberty to adopt laws that appear to be neutral on their face, but that are designed in practice to disproportionately, vastly disproportionately, keep Black American voters, but Latinx voters in the United States away from the polls. The parallels between the voter suppression after 1920 and the voter suppression in 2020 are, I think, chilling.
Striking. All right. So lastly, let me just ask you this, a broad question, because I know you have to go in a moment. The material implications of understanding this history rather than, you know, sort of the fog that we have been living in, and that I include in that broader, you know, question, the implications of statues, like, who cares? I mean, these getting our history right and understanding it is important. Why?
Nobody in this country has a right to vote. That everybody who votes does so at the political behest of the state. Every generation has been characterized by a struggle over the vote. That's true for Black women in 1920. That is true for many Americans today in 2020. Voting rights is a long game. It's the game of ever vigilance, that the political terrain shifts every generation, perhaps even more quickly than that. And so while we are frustrated, perhaps, at where we are in 2020, partly the history reminds us that this is the work of voting rights in the United States. We have never had a golden age of voting rights when everyone voted. And lastly, that the women I write about in Vanguard are not folks who sit down or stay home or fold because they face tremendous hurdles. They know that the work of voting rights, of realizing voting rights, requires organizing and a ground game and a deep commitment and indeed courage. And I think all of those are spot on lessons for an electorate today that is facing both state sanctioned voter suppression and the challenges of a pandemic that mean that turning up and turning out to vote is a risky proposition for many, many of us.
Martha S. Jones, the book is Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks again for joining us. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks. Let's take just a moment before we go to the fun half. I want to read a little bit of emails. We got a bunch of emails that I thought were interesting over the past couple of days. And so I want to read these. Some are corrections of me, which I appreciate, or maybe not full on corrections, but maybe a little bit. We have very, very, we have a very smart audience, and I appreciate that. Got an email from listener Wally. I may be pronouncing his name wrong.
I think Wale.
Wale. The other day we played a clip by Tucker Carlson. I don't know. Maybe it was Friday. I can't remember. And he was talking about how there is no systemic racism because Nigerian immigrants who come to this country are doing well. And Wally wrote in to say, you didn't respond to that bit. And I want to, I didn't, but, you know, I just, there's so much, so much that to respond to with Tucker Carlson that it was difficult. But he wrote me, Nigerian Americans have long been used to dismiss the concerns of Black Americans. The Black conservative economist Thomas Sowell probably started it. But the fact is the Nigerians in America are the ones who could get who could get a visa to America were already well-educated in Nigeria. So they weren't coming to start from the bottom in America. They were already well-educated middle class in Nigeria and most likely highly skilled before they got to America, and will most likely not live in the hood, end quotes. Bearing this in mind, it's a no-brainer that these Nigerian Americans and children will rise up the ladder quicker economically than Black Americans who have had to fight or deal with many structural problems in the American system. The American visa lottery system also selects the well-educated, so they are either already engineers, doctors, accountants, and IT specialists. It doesn't pick the poor in Nigeria. Right. Not to mention, he says, the Nigerian public university system is heavily subsidized by the government. So you can train to be a doctor in Nigeria and graduate debt-free and then relocate anywhere else in the world with your certificate. So, interesting point. If you ever hear that brought up, I mean, yes, I mean, it's obvious. It's not obvious, but I mean, when you contemplate it, of course, if we were able to sort of reach down and have Black people live just from birth in a situation that is not marred by systemic racism, that whether it's the racism that creates massive income or wealth disparities or opportunity disparities or nutrition disparities, and drop them in the, 30 years into their lives, received an education, having received better nutrition, having received better opportunities, et cetera, having not been subjected to the, not growing up as a 17-year-old and getting stopped because you're walking to, somewhere.
Yeah. All these things. Free education to become a doctor. That's indeed pretty big.
Meanwhile, Judith writes in, I grew up in the 50s in Chicago. This was our use of hunky. Somebody on the fun half had asked me, when I first heard that word or if it came from the Jeffersons, and she said, grew up in the 50s in Chicago. Bohunk was known to have been derived from immigrants from Bohemia in Czechoslovakia and turned into the derisive hunky, which I heard used by white people about the still accented Eastern European immigrants who arrived in the first part of the 20th century. And then it must have migrated at one point. Its use widened. So that was interesting. Bohunk. I had no idea. Listener James writes in, I've been calling almost every day for 2 weeks, haven't been able to get through, but then Jamie said something today. This was, on Friday, that I thought was important to rebut. She mentioned that the pre-existing conditions is the only thing that people like about Obamacare. But that's not quite true. I mean, I think she was being, it was more of a shorthand. I think she was talking about there were other sort of patient protections in there, and obviously Medicaid. But James reminds us of something else. The ACA also forced insurance to treat substance abuse disorder and mental illness on par with physical illness. I suffer from major depression and have used drugs to self-medicate. I have gone to treatment to regain my sobriety. Even a low-grade outpatient treatment like that one I went to still runs $15,000 per month without insurance. With insurance, all I paid was my co-pays. Should it have been free? Yes. Should everyone have access, not just to those who are employed? Yes. Of course, government-sponsored healthcare for everyone is a right we should fight for. But right now, as a substance use is on the rise, mental illness is on the rise, suicide on the rise, the ability of a million more Americans to have access to mental care, healthcare, is an important contribution guaranteed under the ACA. Yes, and I think that's a great point. Thank you, James. And I think broadly speaking, I've said this many times before, the official name of the Obamacare or the ACA is actually the ACA PPI, Patient Protection Bill of Rights or something. And it's the patient protections that were really, in terms of those people who need to buy insurance or have insurance across the nation, that was really the only part of the bill that impacted everybody. The ACA part only impacted about 10 million people who bought insurance through the exchanges and was subsidized, and turned out to be not terribly affordable anyways. Certainly, it didn't implicate the cost of insurance for everyone else. And then there's the Medicaid, which is a separate 10 million people. But for the most part, everything in the ACA part of the bill impacted only about 20 million people, which is not nothing, but it is, you know, it's limited. The only part that impacted all Americans was the patient protections, like what James had written about. Keep that in mind. It's just important because, you know, if we're fortunate enough to not have Donald Trump and Republicans in control in 6 months, a lot of these issues are going to be very important. People understand. And George writes me from Rhode Island. Although voter turnout was only 11.4% in the Rhode Island primary last week, we managed to vote out 10 establishment Democratic incumbents from the State House, including the Senate Finance Committee chair, and put in their place strong progressives. Share a platform of $15 minimum wage, single-payer health care, free college, support for Green New Deal-style legislation, and more. Many will run unopposed in the general. So this is a big deal for the left in Rhode Island. This has got to happen in every state across the country, and particularly in blue states, because the states will be a laboratory for the federal government in some respects, and in other respects, some of those elected state representatives will go on to be a congressperson or a senator. And that's important. And then lastly, Fragonard reminds me on the IM, happy Monday, Majority Report crew. Could you please give a shofar salute to recently departed Toots Hibbert, who's not only credited with coming up with the word reggae, but also penned Pressure Drop. In fact, that's the second person to... Just tell me that, I think, today. Who else also told me? Shoot. It was also Gen X Johnson. So for Toots Hibbert of the Maytals, thank you for the opening of the show, which, of course, you know, is really the sort of the Clash version, but the Clash got it from Toots Hibbert. So you're going to get one of these. Rest in peace. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. I'm going to try and take some phone calls, even though I've got some problems with my internet and I'm having trouble staying connected, but that's going to be fixed in a matter of days. It's all just part of it, folks. All right, 646-257-3920, and the IM is on. See you in... Oh, wait. I got to do plugs. Hey, folks, become a member of the show. And... Oh, David Pakman got to 1 million subscribers on YouTube. We were tied like 6 weeks ago, and now he's 70,000 more subscribers than us.
You know, in the Fast and the Furious, when you hit the nitrous oxide button and you go like,
extra, that's what happened. Yeah. Somebody also told me he started like going on like chess tournaments on Twitch or something, and that drove his subscribers. Folks, subscribe to the channel. Get your friends to subscribe to the channel. Let's do this. Let's get to 1 million. I would love to. I don't think it's going to happen now, but our 10-year anniversary is in a month and a half away. There's no way we're going to do 70,000 or 60,000 subscribers in a month and a half, but we can try, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Matt.
I will try.
Thanks for backing me up on that. Also, folks, you can become a member of this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free half of the show, and you get the fun half. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, check out Nomiki's show. You can find it at youtube.com/thenomiki show. God damn it. I said it right the second time, not the first time. I thought I said it right the first time until I said it the second time. But check out our show every day at 3 p.m. You can find that, like I say, Nomiki show on YouTube. Also, check out the Antifada. Jamie's on a camera hiatus today because she's got a scratchy throat, apparently. So, but check out the Antifada. They pre-record, so her voice should be crystal clear. Also, AM Quickie, available at amquickie.com, or you can find it on your podcast. People are loving it.
I'm seeing that shared more and more. The story about the firefighting helicopters in Portland I saw got shared a lot.
Yep. And people should check out the AM Quickie. You can find it at amquickie.com, or you can find it on any of your podcast stuff. Bottom Structure just said, if you, I love you guys, but if you were serious about hitting a million subs, you wouldn't have taken a week long vacation during the RNC. Kidding. But seriously, left is best. We'd scheduled a long time ago and, you know, I had planned it with family members and then, you know, also the coronavirus and blah, 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 blah. Matt, what's happening on TMBS?
Yeah, TMBS tomorrow night, we got two guests. Alicia will be talking to Jesse Macio Vega Fry, who is a Buddhist teacher and writer. And also David Griscom, we're going to have Ben Burgess in to talk about his piece, which is sort of a retrospective on John Ronson's public shaming book that came out in like 2013. And we're going to sort of look back at that and the sort of phenomenon of all of us being sort of volunteer informants on each other. So we'll talk about that. Probably talk about cancel culture a little bit, maybe disagree there. So yeah, patreon.com/TMBS and the Michael Brook Show YouTube channel.
And are you taking any more flight simulations?
Probably hit the skies sometime this week over at twitch.tv/literary hangover.
Where are you going now?
I didn't stream yesterday because I just wanted to do a private flight, but I flew over Robben Island and over Cape Town.
Is it a private flight?
Yeah, it's just I didn't want to be live, but I was listening to Nelson Mandela's autobiography while flying over Cape Town, and I saw Table Island and Table Mountain and Robben Island, and
wow.
Yeah, pretty. It's I got to say, it's my favorite thing. So.
All right. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We'll see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.